We continue in this month of Muharram with our commemoration of the tragedy of Karbala and to keep alive the legacy of Abu Abdullah al-Hussein alayhi salam and his family and friends that sacrificed all that they had on the day of Ashura for nothing other than the preservation of the religion of Allah and the teachings of Rasulullah. And as you'll recall, if you've been with us, we're looking at the passages of Ziyarat of Aminullah. This is a ziyarat which was taught to us by the fourth Imam, Imam Zainul Abidin alayhi salam, that whenever he would want to pay respects to Amir al-Mu'mineen, whether he would directly go to Najaf, or whether he would face the dhari of Amir al-Mu'mineen, or the grave of Amir al-Mu'mineen from Medina, that he would recite this very famous ziyarat that we have with us today. And as we said, that the ziyarat can be broken up into three portions. The initial discussion of the fourth Imam is addressing Allah, communicating with Allah, which is always, obviously always first and foremost, whether it be in the ziyarat or the du'as, we always have our attention on Allah. The second portion of the ziyarat, as we mentioned, is where the Imam enumerates multiple qualities. Not only that he wishes to not only grow within himself, but also that he expects us, the Shias of him, to also try and imbibe within our lives. And then as we mentioned, the last portion of this ziyarat is where he asks his needs, his hajat from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. We continue from where we left off last night. Yesterday, you'll recall, we looked at the line where the Imam was expressing this need that we should be engrossed in the dhikr of Allah and in the dua, to have a love and a connection with Allah through recitation, and not only with the recitation of du'as, but to really understand and want and follow what we ask for from Allah. We look at the next portion this evening, which is on loving the close friends of Allah. And as the line says from the fourth Imam, مُحِبَّةً لِصَفْوَةِ أَوْلِيَائِكَ, bearing love for the choice of your intimate servants. Having a love for the awliya, these certain specific individuals that are within this religion. They're not necessarily named in the Quran by name, but they are known by indication within the Quran, and we know that the Prophet of Islam had spoken about certain personalities in his life, and the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim wassalam would then further elaborate on awliya in the general sense, and also specific examples of who these people, men and women, would be. Before we go really into the line and a practicality of it, I want to try and define the word love. The Quran uses multiple words, at least two. We have the word mawadda in the Quran, and we also have the term mahabba. And we think, or when we look at a translation, we might see that they are translated the same way. At least in English, they're usually translated as love. So mahabbat is usually in English translated as love, and so is mawadda. But we know that if you study the grammar of the Quran especially, and the way that the Arabs would use these kinds of words, that they have multiple meanings. And we mentioned that a few nights ago, that every language has its own nuances. You can't read a word in any language and automatically presume that you know the meaning until you know the context in which it is used. So this definition of love is what I have come up with based on my reading and understanding of what love would be. The English of it, and probably the Farsi's on the screen behind me, it says that love starts off as illogical. It's a romantic, infatuated love. Right? If you think about when you first fell in love with the person that hopefully you married, love didn't really make sense to you, right? Love, even if you ask the philosophers, what is love? Because you can't feel it, touch it, taste it, you can't sense it with our five senses. They say that love really makes no sense. There's no logic behind the initial stage of love. It's just an infatuation. It's something you feel, but there's no real way to actually quantify it or explain it. You say, I love my wife, or I love my husband. But what does that mean? You can say, well, I have a closeness to them, but you're explaining how you manifest that love. But to understand what love is at a level of us loving our, let's say, our spouse or our children or our parents, It's very difficult to actually define what love really is. So it starts off illogical in the preliminary stage. And then after that honeymoon phase is over, we say that a new love replaces it. And that love is what I would term a logical love. So it goes from irrational or illogical, and it then develops into a logical love, what we would call true love. And it's called that because really it's, as opposed to that infatuation that you have with somebody, that lust that you may have for the opposite gender at first glance of that person, that true love, that you know, that ishqe haqiqi, you can't destroy it easily. Right? You might see somebody and you think you love them just by looking at them because they look nice. But then you walk by and you forget that. But if you have that true love for somebody, you know, you marry that partner and you stay with them 30, 40, 50, 60 years, that love is very hard to destroy. It would take, you know, something very, difficult in that relationship for that love to actually destroy itself. Right? So that's why we say that initially love is illogical. But as it grows and matures in relation to a family, or as we'll see with the awliya of Allah, it then becomes a logical true love that really becomes impossible to destroy. Right? A person would never be able to forget that sort of a love. And you can even see this where people get married. They might live 20, 30, 40 years together. They'll get divorced, but they had that love still within them. And maybe some external factor forced them to get divorced. And sometimes they end up remarrying because that love was still between that man and woman. So moving on from that very kind of generic definition of love and trying to explain it in words, we also have to understand, again, reflecting that, we want to try and understand tonight, what does it mean to love the awliya of Allah? What does that love mean? What does that love look like? What does love of the awliya, what does that entail in our lives? So we recognize that love is an emotion, it's a feeling that we have. Again, we can't really understand it to the full extent. It's very unique. It's not like the feeling of hunger or thirst. You know, when I feel hungry, if you haven't eaten for 6, 8, 10, 12 hours, your stomach will let you know that it's hungry. You will feel the pains of hunger. When you're thirsty, your tongue, your mouth will let you know that thirst is setting in, and you will have to obviously quench your thirst or satiate that hunger. So you can feel that, right? And that's at very, you know, at one level. But love, although you can't really sense it, but we can get to a level in terms of our soul, our nafs, our spiritual being that we talked about on the night one, about the body and soul and how we have to nurture the soul, that we can get to a position where our soul can feel empty, where our soul can feel hollow without having the right level of love within it. So although it is an emotion that I said is not really, you know, understood by the five senses, but we can feel, get to a level of feeling that contentment of what it means to be in a state of love. Right? If you give you a very practical example, right? If a person says that they love a particular kind of food, let's say you like chalu kebab or korma sabzi, which is, I love that, so I'll give that as an example. You love that food, but why do you love it? Do you love to touch the food? You're not gonna say, I love kebabs because they feel good, right? You're not going to say, I love the sight of a kebab cooking on a grill, right, on charcoal. You're not going to even say, I hear the sizzling of the kebab and I love the kebab because of the way it sizzles. Maybe the smell might give off, you know, that pleasant aroma, so you like the smell of the kebab. But ultimately, you love the food because of the taste of the food, right? That is really what gets you, is the taste of that food. Right. And that's why even, you know, when we get sick, right, if you get a cold or you get the flu, you can eat the food that you love the most, but you won't enjoy it because your taste buds are not functioning at that time. So you'll eat the kebab or you'll eat the sabzi or you'll eat whatever it is, but you won't enjoy it because you've lost your sensation of taste, right, for a temporary period of time. Now, if we think about spiritual affairs, it's a similar matter. Right? If I say that I love Allah, I'm not going to sense Him with the five senses, but sometimes our soul becomes dead or deafened to the love of Allah, just like our taste buds can lose that sensation temporarily. And through the sins, through the gunas that we perform, we lose that love of connection to Allah. Our soul loses that love of du'as, of ziyarat, of having the love of the awliya of Allah. You think about Dua Kamil, right? We try and recite it every Thursday night. Every Shabba Jummah comes along and we are encouraged by Amirul Mu'mineen to gather in a communal setting. Although we know when he read Dua Kamil and he taught Kamil that Dua, it was just a one-on-one relation. It wasn't in a Husseiniyah that Imam Ali said to Kamil and 1,000 people to recite the Dua. It was Amirul Mu'mineen and one man, the student and the teacher, and the teacher dictated the dua and he wrote it, Kamil wrote it, and we have it today. But when Amirul Mu'mineen taught it to Kamil and he told him to recite it minimum once in your lifetime, if you can do it more once a year, if you can do it more once a month, and if you can do it even more than, you know, every Thursday night you should recite it, every Thursday going on to the day of Friday, I'm sure when Kamil heard the dua for the first time, just as when we heard it, probably the one thing that touched us more than just the resonance of the recitation, especially if you have somebody with a beautiful voice and a good sound system with an echo, is not necessarily the hearing, the actual, you know, the words being articulated, but it probably was the meaning behind the dua. We saw how Amirul Mu'mineen communicated to Allah, how that entire dua from the beginning to the very last line, there is no mention of anything but Allah. And so that love, that affinity to Dua Kamil developed not through the resonance of the words in our ears, but probably through understanding the words. So we develop and our soul develop that passion, that love, that fervor for the Dua through the content of the Dua. We also have to understand, brothers and sisters, that as human beings, our love, whether it's for material things, whether it's for Allah, whether it's for the awliya of Allah, as we were trying to look at tonight, all of our loves, whatever we love, is dependent on what we know of that thing and our relationship to it. And that's why, with the example I gave last night, that sometimes our youth, they know the names of the players on the hockey team more than the names of the imams. They might know the favorite Hollywood movie stars or musicians more than they know the prophets of the Quran, because they haven't developed a love for these personalities. Maybe they've been told to read the Quran and memorize and just regurgitate these words and themes and concepts and names, but they've never studied, let's say, Maryam alayhi salam in the Quran. They've never studied Prophet Ibrahim to know their life, to know the struggles. They've never studied Imam Hussein alayhi salam, maybe other than coming to Muharram Majalis, and they just hear the same story over and over again. And this is what I've heard from even my community back in Ontario. Youth will say, why should I bother coming to the Muharram Majalis? The Sheikh will recite the same event that happened on the day of Ashura that I heard last year and the year before. That's the same story over and over again. Why bother? Right? And that's true. What you'll hear on the day of Ashura, let's say the whole maqtal, that whole musibat of the day of Ashura, it's not going to change. Right? Because what happened on that day and is preserved in books is exactly what the scholars will continue to recite. They're not going to add to it, hopefully. They'll tell us exactly what it was. So many youth don't connect to the Ahlul Bayt and to Islam in general because they haven't developed a connection to the personalities. Right? They love hockey and they love the players. They know their names, the stats of how many goals they scored, how many penalty shots they had and whatever, because they've developed a connection to those individuals at a human level. Many times, what I've been told from many of our youth is they look at the Prophet, they look at the Imams as, you know, super people, people with super characters, super traits, you know, like these Marvel characters, and X-Men, and all these superheroes that you see in the movies. And they say, well, we can't be like them, we can't relate to them, so we don't develop a relationship with them. And we have to realize that I don't have the time, obviously, or the ability now to go into how do we cultivate that love, although that's an important topic, that how do we begin to cultivate love in our children for the Prophet and Ahlul Bayt? How do we cultivate love in our children for the Quran? Because for most communities, I don't speak about your community, but other communities I've been to, Quran is a book to read in Laylatul Qadr. The Quran is put on our head on the night of Qadr. The Quran is used when a bride leaves the home, the father will have her walk under the Quran. The Quran is used maybe in our car, is a little decoration on the rear view mirror. People will take an ayat of the Quran and put it on their screensaver on their phone or their tablet. But we've lost a connection to the Book of Allah. It's become a ceremonial book. And when that happens, then our youth develop, they're indifferent to the Quran because it's just a book of ceremony, just these events in our life. So we need to come together as a community, community leaders, parents, educators. How do we reinstill the Quran in our family? How do we make our families to be Quranic families? How do we make our family love the family of the Prophet? Not to look at them as superhumans with unmanageable or unattainable qualities. And yes, some of the qualities of the Prophet and Imams we would never attain. But how do we make them relatable and thus lovable to our next generation? Salu ala Muhammad wa Ali Muhammad. So as I said, that love is dependent on what we know of that individual or thing and our relationship to it. When I say, for example, and the example that I have on the screen is when somebody says that they love their mother, that love for one's mother or father would not be the same as if a woman says, I love my husband, or a man says, I love my wife. It's two love, love and love, it's the same word. I love my mom, I love my wife. But we know they're at two completely different levels. The love that you would have for your mother is infinitely different than the love that a husband would have for his wife or vice versa. The love for our children would also be different. Even when parents that have multiple children, they say that I love all my children equally. We know that it's sometimes almost impossible to love each child at an equal amount. We would always have a favorite child. So that love would change, the meaning would change. And so again, we go back to the ziyarah when we say love for the awliya of Allah. It's not like I love my mom or my dad. Love of the awliya is not like I love my wife or my family or my children. It is at a very different level. It's a completely different experience when I have that love. There may be some overlapping, but for the most part, that love would be at a different level. And I think for this reason, I want to quote this dua from Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Very beautiful dua that he teaches us about the meaning of love. And he says in the English translation, he says, you are the one who removed the love from the hearts of your friends. The love for meaning everything else in the world. You've removed that love from the hearts of your awliya so that they don't love anybody but you. So this is the maqam, this is the ideal that Imam Hussein is saying we have to get to. That Ya Allah, remove love of everything in the world from my heart, except for your love. Keeping in mind that what Imam is saying is not that we hate or we disregard everything else in our lives. But when we have love for Allah, then we will begin to love everything else that Allah wants us to love, under the shadow of the love of Allah. So then when I say I love my wife, or I love my son, or I love my daughter, I love them because Allah wants me to love them. And I will love them how Allah wants me to love them. I'll treat my family how Allah wants me to treat them. Because my love for them is based on my love for Allah. And so when, for example, the Prophet has been quoted as saying in a hadith, that the best of you is that person who is the best towards his family, and I am the best towards my family. When we see that kind of a hadith, a man would realize that, look, if I love my wife, it's because I love Allah. And because I love Allah, I follow Rasulullah. And because Allah's messenger said that he treated his wives and his children with respect and love and care and admiration, I would never raise a hand to hit my wife, to strike my wife, to hit my children. I would treat them in the way that Rasulullah treated his family. It's not a part of my topic, but we know that some of the wives of Rasulullah were not the nicest to him. You look at Surah Tahrim, chapter 66, and Allah very severely reprimands two of the wives of Rasulullah, very openly in the Quran. There's no, you know, we shouldn't be ashamed about talking about it, but it's not my theme, so I don't want to delve into it. But just to say that Allah reprimanded the wives of Rasulullah for insulting him, for mocking him, for conspiring against him. And he could have used his authority as prophet, as the husband, to do many different things, other than obviously physical attacking. But yet you see how Allah speaks about what they did, and you see how Rasulullah dealt with these women. Right? So he could have done much more, but he maintained a specific path in how he dealt with them. Coming back to this line of the dua, after the Imam says that Allah removed that love of everything else from my heart, that dirt, that dust, that ghibar that accumulates on my heart for everything else, and transplant on that the love of yourself first and foremost. And obviously in the dua, the love for the awliya. But then the Imam says, what does he have who doesn't have you? Right. And the one who has Allah, what doesn't he have? Right. It's a beautiful dua, and I'm sure we've read this. I think it's in the dua of Arafah that Imam Hussein says, alayhi salam, that if a person doesn't have Allah, they might have the fortune and the riches of the world, but they don't have anything in actuality, the Imam is saying. And if we have Allah, then there's nothing we don't have. Right? But unfortunately, we live in a very secular society, a very materialistic world where it's all about wealth, it's all about money, it's all about bling, it's all about fashion, it's all about showing off. And so we run after those things, loving it, thinking that that is what we need in life. But the Imam is saying, look, if I don't even have the entire world, but I have Allah, I have everything at my disposal. Right? And then as the Imam says, that the one who took someone else other than you, Allah, that they have actually become the losers. They've lost in life. Right? So again, we may have everything from the materialistic, the dunyavi point of view, but if we lose Allah, if we lose that ma'naviyat, that spirituality, that connection to the soul that gives us our true existence, right? Allah says in the Quran, there's a verse where it says, Ya ayyuhalladhina amanu, O you who believe, istajibu lillahi wa li rasuli, that answer the da'wah, the invitation of Allah and the Messenger, idha da'akum lima yuhyikum, when they call you to that which gives you life. Right? Now we're all physically alive, so that verse must mean something different, a different kind of life. And it's a life of spirituality, a life of connection to the soul, a life of recognizing the Creator, the Prophets, the Messengers, the Imams, the Awliya, to be able to live a life of value, of purpose, and of worth. Salu ala Muhammad wa Ali Muhammad. So as I said, that love needs to be cultivated primarily and at the very first level, solely for Allah. When we have that love of Allah in our hearts, then love of all that He wants us to love will fall into place. Last night, I believe we quoted that verse of the Quran where Allah says that don't let your amwal, your wealth, and your children divert you from the dhikr of Allah, from Surah Al-Munafiqun. But if we have love of Allah at the primary level in our heart, then love of our wealth and love of children would be permissible because we're loving them, we're using them, not for the wealth in and of itself, but because Allah has given us the wealth, because Allah has permitted us to make use of wealth, because Allah has made wealth at our disposal. So again, it goes back to ensuring that our foundation, our base is on Allah, on the Tawheed of Allah, that we love Allah and we love whatever He wants us to love, but through the love of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And when we do that, then everything else in our life and our lives will fall into place. Our wealth, our work, our families, everything will begin to make sense. We'll put everything in balance and moderation, because it again has begun with Allah. Right? Allah, the perfect being, right? The one who will never change. And when we have that love, then everything else that comes underneath it, including, as we will see, the love of the awliya, begin to make sense. Now, I'm going to try to wrap up in the next few minutes, looking at this line of the dua of the ziyarat, and how in a practical terms this played out at the time of the Prophet of Islam. So the Quran shows us that with the past prophets, the various messengers that came before Rasulullah, one of the prime requests, I could say, of the various past companions and communities of the previous prophets is that they realized that their prophet went through struggles. Prophet Noah, alayhi salam, Nabi Nuh, 2,000 years. Prophet Musa goes through all the difficulties of taking Bani Israel from Egypt, splitting the water, bringing them to what is today occupied Palestine, and they repay him by worshipping the golden cow. He has to go through so many challenges. They insult Nabi Musa, they make fun of him. They ask him for food like onions and lentils and things that they were, you know, wanting other than just generic, boring food that they already had. So all of these prophets of the Quran went through multiple challenges with their communities. But ultimately, they all realized at the end of the day that every prophet that was there for them was doing the work fi sabilillah, just for the pleasure of Allah. They didn't want anything in return, except obviously obedience of their message and submission to Allah. So one of the themes in many verses of the Quran is where companions would ask the previous prophets, what can we give you as a reward, as an ajr for your service? And these past prophets would say that, inna ajriya ala Allah, that indeed my reward, my ajr is with Allah. But when it came to the final prophet, that is our Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam, they asked him a question. They said, you know, you've gone through 23 years of difficulty. That first 13 years in Mecca, where people were calling the Prophet Majnoon, that he's gone, he's divane. They said, you're a magician. They said, you're a poet. They would attack him physically, verbal abuse, character assassination, and so on and so on. 13 years of all of that pressure in Mecca, 10 years in Medina, fighting all of these various battles against the Mushrikeen, against the Ahl al-Kitab, against the Yahud of Yathrib, of Medina. And all of these people come to Rasulullah, and in chapter 42, verse 23, they come with one question, that what can we give you, Ya Rasulullah, for all of your efforts? And Allah tells the Prophet, as we see so many times in the Quran, the word Qul, where the Prophet would be asked, and the Prophet would be ordered by Allah to give a response, and he would wait for Allah to tell him what to do. And in the verse, as we see, it says, قُلْ لَا أَسْأَلُكُمْ عَلَيْهِ أَجْرًا إِلَّا الْمَوَدَّةَ فِي الْقُرْبَى, that I have no demands from you. I don't want anything from you in terms of what I've got done to bring about this message, this revolution of the heart, this revolution of the mind, of the society, except for love of my near relatives. The Quran calls the qurba. Now, this word in itself poses a huge dilemma, because there are multiple opinions from the non-Shia commentators, especially of what does the word qurba mean. There are strange opinions from some commentators, not even based on hadith, just their own conjecture, their own thoughts of what the Quran means. And they would, for example, say that it means to love the companions. Okay, so if you say, the Prophet said, I ask you nothing in reward except for love of my companions, which companions do you follow? Do you follow, for example, the likes of Muawiyah, that fought against Imam Ali alayhi salam, two apparent companions fighting one another, and the ones that are Sunni brethren say, may Allah be pleased with both of them? How do you love both of them equally when one launched illegal wars against the other one? Do you love some of the wives of the Prophet in Medina, the ones that launched, for example, the Battle of Jamal? You have to love her, although she launched a war against the Imam of her era, and you have to love her in the same way? So if you have companions as a definition for qurba, it can't fit with a narrative of Islam, because you can't love people that kill and are responsible for, you know, mass casualties. What does that mean? That means there has to be another opinion. Some scholars have said, well, the qurba are acts of worship. So the Prophet said, if you want to repay me, love acts of ibadah. Love the namaz, love the fasting, love the hajj. But again, it doesn't make sense. And so this is where we come to a hadith that is mentioned, not even in our books. This is mentioned by Al-Hakim Al-Haskani, a Sunni scholar who has a two-volume book, which he compiles all of the ayat in the merits of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam. It's called Shawahid al-Tanzil. It's originally in Arabic. There's a Farsi translation. It was recently published in English as well, in two volumes. And he takes a look at all of the verses of the Quran and how they are related to the fadilat of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam. So when he comes to this verse, 42, verse 23, he says that when this verse was revealed, the companion said, Ya Rasulullah, who are those whose love Allah has commanded us to seek? Who are these dil qurba? Who are the qurba that you are wanting us to have the mawadda for in exchange for the message that you had delivered? And non-Shia scholar quotes the hadith. He says that the Prophet said that this is related to Ali, to Fatima, and their children. Salu ala Muhammad wa Ali Muhammad. Muhammad wa Ali Muhammad. So even the non-Shias, they have a concept of love of the Ahlul Bayt. And we don't want to take that away from them. Unfortunately, we know that their world has been confused with Wahhabis and Sunnis. For the most part, most Sunnis are good people. They have love for the Ahlul Bayt. I've seen in communities in Edmonton, for example, in Vancouver, where I was living recently, that even Sunni communities have what we have here, this 10 nights of Muharram. I've seen Sunni communities commemorate Muharram in the similar way that we do. Yes, they won't do the Sina Zani, they don't do that. That's not a part of their culture, we can say. But they gather, a scholar will come, he'll talk about the Ahlul Bayt, he'll give a religious talk, he'll speak about the tragedy of Karbala. But unfortunately, when Wahhabism took over and the petrodollars took over, that began to muddy the environment. But generally, Sunnis love Ahlul Bayt, alayhim as-salam. They'll come and attend majalis. I saw that in South Africa when I went for Muharram. In my own hometown of Kitchener, we've had Sunnis come to the majlis of Imam Hussein. They donate, they give money in terms of feeding the community, because they have the love of Ahlul Bayt, because they recognize verses of the Quran like this are a part of their life as well. And they see these hadith and they realize that they too are obligated to love the family of the Prophet. Now again, they don't love them and follow as we do. But we can say again, as I said the other night, that that is again our fault, because we haven't been able to get the message out to them to show them what it means to love and follow the Ahlul Bayt. And if we can instill that in them, then I have no doubt that they will gladly welcome the Ahlul Bayt into their hearts, and they would take part in the programs and be as us, as the followers of Muhammad and Ali Muhammad alayhim salam. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa Ali Muhammad. I will conclude with one last portion. Another beautiful dua, again from our fourth imam. Again about love and what love of the awliya means. And love of the awliya obviously also relates to loving the Rabb of the awliya, loving Allah. Because when we can love Allah in the real way, as we've mentioned tonight, as we've tried to touch upon, then love of the awliya becomes easy, because Allah wants us to love them. And Imam Sajjad says in this very beautiful dua, Munajat, he says, My Lord, Ilahi, even if you were to bind me in chains and prevent me from witnessing your blessings, I would never cut off my hopes from you. I would not turn my imploring face away from seeking your forgiveness, and your love would never leave my heart. Even Amir al-Mu'mineen Dua Kumail, he has a similar line where Allah, even if you were throwing me into the fire, I would still sing your praises amongst the people of hell. That's a love, brothers and sisters, a status that we have to try and aspire to attain, where we have that deep, committed love to Allah within our hearts. It doesn't come overnight. It would take years of understanding Allah, of studying the Quran, studying Allah, understanding the Ahlul Bayt, understanding the Awliya of Allah, how they got to that status. Reading the du'as, as I said last night, reading the du'as with understanding, with contemplation, with tafakkur on what the imams would say and how they communicated to Allah. But ultimately, when we get to that level, we would be like, maybe like Imam As-Sajjad, where we could say, Ya Allah, even if you threw me into hell, you shackled me with chains, you burnt my very existence, I still would not give up having love for you.